You want to take some calls with me? I am so excited for this.
Yes, let's hear it. Let's
Let's do
hear it from
this.
our people.
We have Matthew on from Athens, Ohio. Hey, Matthew, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So you're on with me and my friend Mike Solomonov.
Hey, Matthew.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm good.
All right, what should we talk about?
Well, I want to talk about eggplant, more specifically in the context of moussaka. And can I give you a little history?
Yeah.
Love history.
Well, way back in my college days, there was a little diner owned by a Greek couple about a half block from the campus gate, and I discovered the all-encompassing joy of moussaka. And I treated myself to that pretty regularly all through college. And then after college, and I'd met the person I was going to spend my life with, I thought I'd learn to make it on my own, found a good basic recipe, and the lamb was terrific, and the bechamel topping was terrific, but I could never get my eggplant to the texture of the eggplant in the moussaka that I had discovered at this diner. My eggplant always came out kind of mushy, maybe oily, maybe watery. And my first encounter with eggplant in moussaka was that it was sort of tender and buttery and sort of a bread-like texture.
Huh.
And I wonder if you know what I'm talking about, and if you can give me any idea for a cooking technique that'll get me that kind of a texture. I've tried roasting, I've tried grilling, I've tried frying. I even saw a recipe where you put a heavy pan on top of it while you're pan roasting it. And I'm never happy with the results.
Right. Well, Matthew, I understand your pain. I mean, eggplant is a really finicky thing, and I was just talking to my partner Steve Cook, and who was in Israel recently, and he was like, "I'm not sure what it is, but the eggplant in Israel needs very little. Like, you don't, you know, here in the States, the practice in restaurants and even in the home is to treat the eggplant. You always have to slice it, salt it, press it, drain it, sometimes rinse it. You know, we brine our eggplant at Zahav. But I think that I would try two things." What I would do is slice the eggplant thin and brush it with salt. Let it hang out for about a half an hour in a colander and try to squeeze a little bit of the water out of it. And then from that point, what you can do is brush it with olive oil and roast it so it mimics the sort of like lasagna sheets. But if you want it really tender, I mean, the weird thing is that if you just sort of like pack it in there with the meat and the bechamel and bake it, provided that the eggplant is sort of fresh, it will roast and get creamy in there. It'll sort of steam and roast. I prefer the two-part cooking method when it comes to moussaka. I really like the sear or the saute and then the bake. I find that to be better. But if you want the sort of creamy, sort of luscious quality that the eggplant has, I would
That's what
just
I'm
sort of
looking for.
salt. I would salt it, squeeze it, and then just sort of pack it in there with the meat and bechamel. Right on. And does the type of eggplant matter?
It does. The problem is that you're not going to be able to find. You're sort of at the whim of like the grocery store in which you buy the eggplant. You know, so water content, seed content. And sort of the composition of fiber really depends on like factors that we have no control over, unfortunately, and season as well. And you're in Ohio, is that right?
Yes, in Ohio.
I mean, so you're getting California or like Mexican eggplant most of the year.
Well, we have a really good farmers market here. And if there's a variety of eggplant I should be looking for, I could ask around.
I mean, I think that like the Italian eggplant is kind of what you want. I just you're not getting eggplant though, you know, from now till June, right? I mean, it's not going to be local.
It's going to be a grocery store, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I would just get comfortable with that, and then, you know, I would concern myself with the thickness and the sort of curing of it with the salt, and I would sort of play around with those methods.
And that searing, would you say at a high temperature, at medium temperature?
I would say high temperature for a very short period of time. Yeah, and I understand your love for moussaka. It's really one of my favorite things. My grandmother was Sephardic Bulgarian, so they spent a lot of their time sort of with Ottoman influence in their cooking.
and they didn't keep kosher. So we always had good moussaka, and I think it is a really special thing.
Well, I do too. I love it. I used to make it about once a year, usually around Easter or around my birthday in April, because I think of lamb as a spring thing.
Definitely, yeah, nice. Definitely. But I feel like when it gets cold out, it justifies you eating like these like 4,000 calorie slices of moussaka. And cold. Oh my god, cold for breakfast is like the best thing ever.
Really, I don't think I've ever eaten it cold.
Yeah, I mean that's like an American thing. that's not very traditional. Yeah. Do you put cinnamon in your bechamel?
Yes. Oh, well, I put cinnamon in the ground lamb, and then I top it with a little more cinnamon on the bechamel. Yeah.
Very important. Good. Good to hear.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Seal of approval.
I'll give it a try.
Give it a shot, Matthew. Let us know how it goes.
I will.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for taking me.
It's great to talk with you.
See ya.
That was great. I have absolutely nothing to add to that.
That's not, you can just chill.
This is great.
I like it when people get really sort of intrigued by like ethnic food, you know, and they get, I know people that, you know, grew up in the States. They had a roommate that was like from Greece or from Turkey. They taught them how to stretch phyllo in their college dorm, and they make like fresh baklava like all the time. I think
that's
so
awesome.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. So we are taking your calls. I'm with my friend, Mike Salamov, the chef of Zahav and the author of Israeli Soul. And, we just talked about eggplants. How many eggplants do you go through in your restaurants in like a week?
There's not a number for the amount. It's infinite. We go through so much eggplant. We probably go through, I don't know, anywhere between 2 and 3 cases a day.
In just Zahav?
Yeah, in just Zahav.
What do you do with them?
Everything. Everything. We grill. We roast. We've got the sort of like eggplant salad that's twice cooked. We do kind of like a baba ganoush. But honestly, eggplant, we will split an eggplant, brine it in like salt water, and then grill it as like an entree.
Oh, cool.
With tahina. Yeah, and people, it's probably one of our most popular entrees, and it happens to be vegan.
Cool. So we are going to go to our next caller. We have Kate calling in from Wake, Virginia. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. You're on with me and also my friend Mike Salamanov.
Hey, Kate.
How exciting. How are you? It's so nice to speak with you both.
Well, thank you. And what should we speak about?
Let's see. My husband works at a local boarding school, and it's an international school. So he has a small group of students who are coming to dinner. And two of the students are from China, so obviously far from home. And they asked for me to make them ramen, which I said, sure, okay, I'll do, and without having ever made it before. And then, you know, I get looking at recipes and started panicking a little bit, as the broth in and of itself is quite a gesture of love to give to anybody. So, okay, so I'm panicking a little bit. I've got a weekend. I live in very rural Virginia, so getting, you know, seaweed is going to be a challenge, but I have time to get down to a city to, you know, I can get this stuff. If you could help me get organized and get my brain around what actually has to happen to have it be good, authentic ramen for these kids so far from home.
Okay. So this is actually a really big question. I don't know if I can answer every possible scenario.
Right.
One thing is that ramen is traditionally, the word ramen, although it has origins in Chinese food, it actually is a transliteration from basically lo mein, but it's Japanese. And so if they're saying ramen, I'm wondering if they're actually referring to the Japanese dish, ramen.
Okay.
Which is
okay.
Not actually, you know, the Chinese noodle. So I wonder if, I mean, they might actually mean they want instant ramen. Because I don't know where they're...
I mean, that's what the American kids are expecting.
I don't know, because I grew up... I ate so much instant ramen when I was a kid, and it was like totally
right?
a thing in our family. Yeah, totally. And there are like Chinese versions of it and with Chinese flavors, but
the Korean versions of ramen, like the shin bowl, is like one of my favorite things to eat.
Unbelievable.
It's good. It's 104% of your daily sodium allowance, but it is amazing.
Okay.
It is amazing.
And super spicy. Yeah, like Shin Ramyun is
the
Korean brand. S-H-I-N R-A-M-Y Ramyun. R-A-M-Y-O-N.
Okay.
Yeah. It's my favorite. And I can't tell if it's the chilies or if it's the salt burning your esophagus that make
yum.
It so good. But it is so good.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's a super delicious one.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the mm-hmm. idea of like sending you down the wrong road.
I think it's a really tricky thing to do because I think that first of all, like I find I'm like unclear about what it is that these students actually want. Secondly,
right.
I think having to recreate anything authentic in air quotes, like not uh-huh. in the right context is an impossible thing to do,
yeah.
you know?
Right.
And I think
okay.
that also in, you know, like in rural Virginia, trying to find ingredients that, that may be even close to what it is that you're going to, I would go a different route.
Okay.
I would make
burger
like
bar
chicken
right
noodle.
In.
I would make like chicken noodle soup. You know, if you want to, what you know, when you sort of alkalize the noodles, have you done that recently where you basically add like yeah. baking soda to like boiling pasta and it sort of ramenizes?
Oh,
them?
Really?
Wow.
Have you ever,
I've never done that.
It's the easiest. Yeah. It's literally adding like X amount of baking soda and sometimes salt to water the Ideas in Food people, Alexander Talbot does uh-huh. an amazing sort of version of ramen noodles where it is like spaghetti or something that is super basic. I can't remember. But if you check it out, just Google Ideas in Food and like ramenized noodles or whatever, you'll
okay.
see it. And it's like adding spaghetti or linguine to water that has got like baking soda in it, and it makes the
okay.
noodles ramen-esque.
That gives them that like chewy
yeah.
texture.
Chewy, exactly. Very awesome.
Very good.
My kids, mm-hmm. I have a 4 and a 7-year-old that are like the pickiest yeah. eaters in the world. For some reason, they love Asian noodle soup. That's like one of the
okay.
four things. And so for me to get them to eat like chicken noodle soup, I have to treat noodles this way.
That's so
because
okay.
it's reminiscent of like ramen, you know, and that's like what
right.
they trust. So
okay.
I would make, you know, I would, what's your favorite soup? What's the iconic soup that you make like for yourself or what you
I love making soup. I just love a really good chicken stock with some Asian noodles. And, you know, we fry the garlic in the oil and it gets all kind of crunchy
oh, yeah.
and toasty and a lot of cilantro and a handful of, you know, this and that. And
it sounds like something that we want here in this studio.
In this studio.
And it's probably what the students want.
Yeah,
so
I think
give them
okay.
that.
They'll be pretty psyched about that. Yeah, look at that noodle treatment.
Yeah.
That ramenized
okay.
noodle treatment. Or, you know, serve them something like Mike said that you feel comfortable making, that you're happy to make, that you're happy to eat, and
yeah.
welcome them into your home and into your world.
That's what I'll do. That's exactly what I'll do. Thank you so much, both of you, for your help.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Could go for some soup, some noodle soup right now. You
know? Totally.
You should check out this method, though. It's really cool.
That's so I've
yeah.
never heard of that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's awesome.
All right, let's do it. We have Rachel from Minneapolis, home base.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my question.
It's a pleasure to talk with you.
So my question is about a technique. I've recently gotten into black garlic. I love it on everything. And I realized I can make it in my rice cooker using my warming setting. For me, it's about 2 weeks until the garlic's ready. And I've been making a lot of it. And I thought to myself, what else can I make using this technique? So I thought I'd ask you if there's something else I can be doing in my rice cooker similar to how I'm making black garlic.
This is a great question. I have never made black garlic. I have to say, though, this is super funny timing because I just this morning was talking to Rene Redzepi, and he has a book called The Noma Guide to Fermentation, which is an incredible book. And there's a whole chapter on black garlic and black other things. So the very simple answer is go buy the book because they have spent.
The really simple answer is other things.
They have spent all the hours and all the time and all of like the terrible things to blacken to find all the delicious ones. But reading through that chapter, I remember you can make shallots the same way you would make black garlic. So
okay.
you have, okay, so black garlic, for listeners who don't know about it, is basically garlic that has been left to, I guess not technically ferment, but sort of like cook itself or have like this intense enzyme reaction where if you basically leave the garlic hanging out in a 140 degree room or in a rice cooker set on the warm setting for a few weeks or even a month, the garlic comes out and it looks black. Like the garlic cloves all look super black. They're kind of soft, they're kind of taffy-like, and they have this intense, delicious umami garlic soy sauce.
Sweet, too.
Sweet
caramel
flavor.
Yeah,
it's like a incredible caramelized garlic. It's like roasted garlic times 1,000.
Yeah.
And you can just like spread it on a piece of roast chicken, or you can mix it with butter, and you can do all these crazy, awesome, delicious things with it once you have that thing. So you can use that same method for shallots and make black shallots, which is like the caramelized onion version of this like caramelized garlic vibe.
I am doing that.
And they also have all these methods for doing like black apples, which sounds incredible. Black chestnuts.
I wonder if you could do like black citrus. Like we use black limes a lot with sort of Persian cooking.
Yeah.
Where you dry out citrus. And I'm wondering if it would do sort of the same thing.
Yeah. Do you know how black limes are made?
I mean, you literally put them. No, you could do them in sun, or you could do them like low temperature above an oven for a very long time. But I would imagine it wouldn't be that far off. And black limes are really good. Black garlic is amazing. I also love, Francis, how you started the conversation by saying, I was on the phone with Renee Rizzetti earlier today. You've been waiting all day to say that. Like, it was like you were in the elevator on the way to the office, and you were like, to some stranger, I was on the phone with Renee Rizzetti.
Yeah. Oh, when Michelle Obama and I were hanging out. All right, Rachel, so have fun blackening things. And, like, I mean, I would definitely look at that book. Or you can just experiment and know that some experiments go well and some will make you regret it.
I've been hesitant to experiment because I am concerned about food safety, and I'm not a trained chef, so I thought I'd come to the people who know what they're doing. Do you know, Francis, if this technique has a name?
Oh, I just know it as blackened. Well, I don't know.
I don't think so, because I feel like black garlic is kind of, was
its own
up
thing.
Until recently kind of its own thing.
Yeah.
Like a low temp, long term fermentation. I feel like we should have a name.
That's a really beautiful acronym.
Long term
fermentation. Lutf.
Yeah, exactly.
Lutf.
That sounds actually pretty Nordic.
Yeah.
Which works in Minnesota.
Yeah, of course.
Cool. Have fun blackening things.
Good luck with everything. Thank you.
I will. I'll check out that book. Thanks for the recommendation.
Right on. Take care. All right. We have Katie from St. Louis. Hey, how are you, Katie?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You are on with my friend Mike Solomonov. He's the chef of Zahav. And what would you like to talk about?
Yeah. So I have started making homemade Greek yogurt. And every time that I do it, I use like a gallon of milk, and I end up getting about a quart of acidic whey left over. So I was wondering, what can I do with all of this whey that I have? I have been putting some on my like acid living plants, like my rose bushes and azaleas, but they can only take so much.
They can only take so much. Hey, Katie, this is Mike. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. So we make labneh, we make yogurt and all that at Zahav. We always have leftover. We brine vegetables in it, and
it is
awesome, so good. We also, you can poach things like potatoes and stuff in there, and it, you can add it to, I don't know if you make ice cream, but it helps sometimes smooth out ice cream bases. And honestly, like, I use it for smoothies, fruit smoothies, because it's got all types of good stuff in there. So I would say that.
Tell me about brining vegetables and whey.
So it's cool because you've got acidity, and depending on the salt content of what it is that you're making, you've got a little bit of salt in there, but you can always add like salt and honey to this whey, and then you could drop like eggplant, zucchini, green vegetables, things that you like to roast, you know.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. Also, if you get some tomatoes that are a little bit underripe, I like to score them a little bit and drop them in the whey for like 25 minutes, and they're just like delicious, really, really tasty.
Oh, it just like pulls in that little bit of tang.
Exactly. And it's kind of what you want. I mean, think about, it's sort of like this like yogurty consomme, right? So, I mean, the things that you, like cooking oatmeal with it, delicious. Like there's, if you think about sometimes what you want out of yogurt, but you can't like mess with because of the cooking of it.
Oh, yeah.
It works in those applications. Cooking grains in it too. So good. Oh, so cool. Good. And if you wanted to like stew meat or like braised like a veal breast or that kind of thing, it would also work nicely.
Yeah.
I feel like there was that sort of time in, I guess, the early 2000s where like Michel Bra came out. You know, he's the chef from the Abrac region in France. And he started using whey to like poach like lobsters and stuff like that. And it really sort of, it implies the sort of like milk fat and it implies acidity without really having too much of any of it, you know? So in the same way that buttermilk is really used as this sort of like crutch to a lot of different things, the yogurt whey does the same thing. But yogurt whey, I mean, it has like tons of protein in it. It's got really good stuff in it as well. So I definitely think even with like stone fruit and sort of summer berries, that sort of thing, it works really nicely.
Super cool.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll have to give that a try.
Oh, yeah. Also, if you like granitas, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think you add a bit of sugar. Like, I don't know if I'd use honey necessarily. That would conflict with the texture. But, you know, take a little bit of, like, you know, flax and a little bit of, like, agave or some natural sugar. Mix it up with the whey. Put it in the freezer. And every 30 minutes until it's totally frozen, take it out and shred it up with a fork. And you've got something really fresh that you can kind of, like, dump on melons for breakfast.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a good idea.
That sounds super great. Also, like, weirdly awesome. Healthy.
Yeah.
Like, when you start throwing in flax, I'm like, oh, that's going to make you live forever.
It flax is, I know, it is good stuff, but flax has got good texture in the right application,
yeah.
too.
I love toasted flax seeds.
Toasted flax seeds are awesome, and they're sort of gummy, but they also are really nice and crisp, and flax is tremendously healthy.
Cool. I hope you got some ideas, Katie.
Yeah,
let us know how it goes. Yeah, thanks so much, Anto. I'll have to give those a try.
Great. See ya.
Happy yogurt making.
All right, thanks,
Edna. All right, thanks, bye. After you brine the vegetables in whey, do you cook them or do you, like, pickle them in the whey?
No. I like to brine them in the whey and then yank them out and, like, grill them. You know, I think it's really nice. Or roasting is really good, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's good. I'm trying to think of what else I would cook with whey. Like, I feel like potatoes would make a lot of sense. You know when you do, like, the brandade sort of thing, and you go like potatoes uber savory with like anchovies or salt cod. You know, typically you take the salt cod and you cook it in like milk, but what if it was like potatoes, whey, garlic, anchovy? I think it would make a lot of sense, you know?
That'd be cool. I want to go try that. Cook potatoes in whey and then whip them. Mike, it's been awesome hanging with you today, man.
It has been so fun hanging out with you. We got to do this again. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such a pleasure catching up, bro.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you.
Mike Solomonov's new book is called Israeli Soul, and he left us with his recipe for that awesome tahina shake. You can find it at splendidtable.org, at splendidtable.org, at splendidtable.org, at splendidtable.org, at splendidtable.org.